I want to take just a minute here and make more than just a casual mention of my co-authors. If I can make have a pointer. What do you do? Point at the computer, maybe? Anyway, let me just say thank you to my co-authors and the papers in your proceedings as well as the presentation here. Dr. Rawl, in the midst of organizing this really good convention that you all are enjoying and stopped and taking time to help me with the editing and modifying the materials that you're going to see here this morning and those that are in your proceedings. It's been really interesting to work with Dr. Rawl and Dr. Kropp. I see Dr. Kropp over there, too. Imagine, I was thinking about this last night, if you want to kind of get a feel for what it's been like, imagine, if you will, a stagecoach hurtling down a mountain road or path, if you will, with lots of twists and turns and rocks in the way. And I'm in the middle of the seat holding the reins, and Megan has served as the person sitting to my right. She's sitting there by that big long wooden stick. I think they used to call them brakes. Okay, and so when we come to something like something that maybe she thought we'd ought to back off on a little bit, she said, "Well, maybe we ought not be quite so bold about that, or maybe you ought to say just in case, or say something like." It is possible that, or perhaps, or something like that. So she's sitting there on that seat with the stagecoach bouncing around. She's hanging on for dear life with one hand and hauling back on the brake with the other hand. And then there's Dr. Kropp. And a lot of you know Dr. Kropp, and he's been around long enough that he's just not bashful. He's standing on the back of the stagecoach where all the boxes and things have already bounced off, and he's got his legs spread wide and he's hunched over and he's got a 30-foot bullwhip and he's wearing those horses out with the bullwhip while Megan sits up there and bounces around and she's pulling back on the brake because he's telling me, he says, "You know, you don't need to beat around the bush." He says, "Tell it like it is. Say what you mean and mean what you say." And so on. And so it's been really interesting to work with Dr. Kropp and Megan, and we all get along well, and they provided a lot. So I just want to thank them for that. And the other thing I want to say about Dr. Kropp, other than helping keep the horses going on the stagecoach, he has basically taught these principles relative to matching cows to forage type for somewhere in the neighborhood of 35 years in our department. And so we feel like our students have a good foundation when they leave Oklahoma State relative to some of the principles that we're going to cover here today. And that's very important. Then I also want to just say thanks to Dr. Mike Brown, who has done a lot of work in the area of genetic by environment interactions. We have had a good working relationship between Oklahoma State and USDA station there at El Reno for many, many years. It's been very beneficial. And then the graduate students, Dylan, Spark, Sarah Lanine, and Elisa Rippey just joined us from the great state of Kansas, and they've all contributed in a lot of different ways, and I very much appreciate their contributions, as well as Ann Maurer, Chelsea Dobbs, and Casey McMurphy, and I think they're all here today, too. But you're going to see quite a bit of the work that they've done. Okay, so just what I'd like to do is start out from a 30,000-foot view, and our extension educators in the room have seen something like this or some version of it, and they've actually helped me modify this quite a bit, so I really should acknowledge them as well. We've been working on this idea of matching cows to forage resource and kind of an extension for us for 4 to 5 years now, and they've been very helpful and helped modify and inform some of these concepts, but we're going to start out with that 30,000-foot view, kind of review where the industry's been, take a look at where we're going and where we're at, and then talk about some of the implications, and then wind up with maybe some of the suggestions. Some of them will be new, and some are old and kind of fundamental principles. That's kind of what we're going to do. So Dr. Bob Todashek was a past department head in our department several years ago, been retired for some time now, and he gave a wonderful presentation at the Oklahoma Cattlemen's Association several years ago. And what you're going to see here at the first part of this is parts of his presentation. And he started out with the trail drives that Mr. Reese described when he welcomed you yesterday morning. And Dr. Todashek then worked his way through kind of the turn of the last century here. This is a grand champion bull. And all I want you to notice here, you know, is that that's, I think we would consider that kind of a modern type bull in today's industry. And then Dr. Todashek says in the 40s and 50s, the cattle industry entered into what he calls an era of insanity. And many of you know exactly what I'm talking about. What happened? Cattle size went down, right? Somebody decided that smaller and fatter was better. Now, this might have been more related to the show industry than it was to commercial cattle operations, you know, out west and out in the remote areas. I really couldn't say. But I know for a fact that this occurred for sure in the seed stock industry at the shows. And at that time, that was the major way in which cattle were evaluated. We didn't have national cattle evaluation at that time. Okay, and then in the 60s, there was a recognition for the need to change. And some of you will recognize this slide. You see in the background there, and I can't get my pointer to work. In fact, Gant or Dr. Stein, if you could help, if there's a way to get that thing to work or a different kind of pointer, it would help me out. I'm kind of tied to my pointer. But, sorry? Okay, well, if you can help with that, I'd appreciate it. If not, we'll get by. Dr. Good is the person on the far left standing behind the steer's hip. Of course, Dr. Good is a past department head at Kansas State University, longtime department head, very well respected in the industry. And on this day, at the premier livestock show in the world, at the time, Dr. Good slapped this crossbred steer's grand champion. And I think Dr. Kropp was standing in the audience somewhere as one of the livestock judges on the team. And Dr. Kropp, I've heard you say it before, but what was the audience's reaction when that happened? What do you remember?
It was amazing.
First crossbred steer to ever win Chicago. What I heard him say before is that you could have heard a pin drop. Is that accurate? And so, you know, people were maybe shocked and surprised, but it was Dr. Good and other folks' signal to the world that things needed to change. And in fact, that concept was valid from a scientific standpoint and could help the industry. And it was a pivotal point in the cattle industry. The problem is that the pendulum didn't stop in the middle. In the 70s and 80s then, the era or the cattle industry returned to what Dr. Todashek described as just a return to insanity. And so you think back and tell me what happened then. Most of us were old enough to remember this. In fact, I was. I was in judging livestock in high school when this was going on, and I remember. And that's just, aren't very good pictures. But the other kind of cattle in the 40s and 50s were belt buckle cattle. These are hat band cattle, right? And in fact, you can't see very many hat bands. And also, it's really interesting to me, if you look at pictures from this area, how stubborn we are in the cattle business. Notice that they don't move the people out from behind the cattle so you can tell who they are. All you see is boots and jeans. Okay? This is 1986 at the National Western in Denver. Same deal. You tell me who's standing behind that bull. Some of you know, because you know what bull that is. Okay, and then, and we can go on. It wasn't just steers. It wasn't just one breed. It was breed after breed after breed. You can come up with pictures like that. Okay, and so then in the 90s and 2000s, Dr. Todashek says, we're back again. Somebody decided that we had pendulum had swung too far once again, and now we needed to come back to the middle. That actually was better for the industry from an economic and efficiency standpoint. And sure enough, we did. And if you look at most of the genetic trend data, most of the breeds today that have yearling height or mature height information, you can see that for quite some time now, frame size has moderated and remained constant. Okay, so you know, I think that those are good changes. Sometimes it takes us a long time to learn those lessons, and sometimes we have to learn them the hard way. So matching forager resources is my responsibility here today, and my question is, are we getting closer? And most of this presentation is going to be from a commercial cow-calf operation perspective. And the reason I say commercial is because what I'm referring to is a production system where inputs are moderate to low, recognizing that we no longer live in a $2 corn world, we live in a $7 or $8 corn world. And so inputs, purchased and harvested feeds in particular, are going to be really expensive. And forage is still the least cost input that we have on these operations. So that's the perspective. Some of the issues we talk about will be relative to a sell at wean context. Some of them apply to a complete production system. Okay, so this is standardized performance analysis data from Dr. Stan Beaver's group at Texas A&M, and it just shows the cost per hundredweight to produce calves in his database from Oklahoma, Texas, and New Mexico. And then the blue line is the average calf price received by those same operations. Okay, so, you know, it's obvious that even though calf prices have we've seen and enjoyed all-time highs in the last few years, on average, folks that participate in this program are not able to benefit from that in a very substantial way because the input costs have risen enough to offset those record high calf prices. And so what we have to do, if you're a commercial cow-calf operation, what you have to do is really focus. And Dr. Damona Doy in our ag econ department tells me this all the time. She says, all that production stuff is great, but in order to be profitable, what you have to focus on is minimizing or reducing your production costs. She says you have to control your costs. And that's been her message to me for years. So this is Dickerson. I saw some of this posted yesterday, Matt and Bob Weber and Dr. Dickerson's suggestions relative to what the job description is for an efficient cow. And it's still very relevant today. She needs to have early sexual maturity, a high rate of production, reproduction, low rate of dystocia, longevity, minimum maintenance requirements, and the ability to convert forage resources to pounds of calf from beef. So that would, the last one there would be the reference to the output. The rest of those, well, I guess some of the others are related to output too in terms of dystocia and longevity. But a lot of reference there to fertility and maintenance requirements. Okay, so knowing that the industry has had kind of a propensity, Duane, to swing the pendulum from one extreme to another, and knowing that we have made a lot of changes genetically in cattle, let me just ask you, just from a production standpoint, if we're looking at commercial cow-calf operations, has, let's just say, weaning weight and weaning rate improved? What do you think? Some say yes. Most of you don't want to, haven't had your coffee yet. Well, let's just take a look. I've got three databases here. I wish I had more information on this. But what I've got is information from the Southwest SPA data set, standardized performance analysis from Texas, Oklahoma, New Mexico. That'll be the blue line. And what you see there is that basically since 1990, if that's any, if this data set's a good indication, there effectively has been no change in winning weight in commercial cow-calf operations. Okay, over time, if we draw a trend line through that, it'd be flat as could be. What about Kansas? This is the Kansas Farm Management Association data set, and it would, in 2011, I think it contained at least about 130 operations, as I recall. Okay, so this is weaning weight, a little bit better weaning weights in those operations. You could maybe argue, if you ignored the first 4 years in that data set, that maybe there's been a gradual increase. If you drew a trend line through that, it might be trending upwards, but certainly it's been flat the last few years. Okay? Last data set then is from North Dakota. Dr. Chris Ringwald shared this information with me from his Cowherd appraisal performance software in their SHAPS program. And in the last year, as I recall, it includes some around 80 commercial cow-calf operations. So it's interesting they had higher weaning weights there early in this data set, and then kind of a pretty big drop-off. And it looks like maybe since about 1996, perhaps a gradual increase since that time. But overall, if you were to draw a trend line through that, it would be pretty flat, too. And so I'm suggesting that at least from these days, now there will be individual ranches out here, and I'd be very interested and welcome you to provide your input, catch up with me later. If you have substantial data that says that yes, over time, in your production system, your weaning weights have improved consistently, I'd love to see that. What about weaning rate or reproduction? And this is percent of calves weaned compared to the number of cows exposed to the bull the previous year. Okay, Southwest data set kind of bounces between somewhere around 80 and 84% most of the time. Okay, averages just a little over 82. But effectively no change over time since that data was begun to be collected there in the early 90s. This is the Kansas data set. Kind of a rough estimate of their weaning rates. But again, if you were to draw a trend line through that, it would be pretty flat. And then this is the green line is the North Dakota data set. So effectively, you know, it looks like, at least in from North Dakota to Texas, if this data is indicative of what's going on in the industry, there really has not been dramatic improvements in weaning weight or weaning rate. And that concerns me. Now, the other interesting thing about this is the South has got some work to do, right? Isn't it interesting? I mean, obviously, it would be difficult to improve on 91% average weaning rate in North Dakota. That's incredible, especially if you're from the South. That's incredible. So they're doing a really good job. Are their cattle matched better to their forage resources in North Dakota than they are in Texas, than we've been doing down here in the South? I don't know the answer to that. Maybe their inputs are higher in North Dakota. But we're averaging a little over 82 in Oklahoma, Texas, and New Mexico, and they're averaging about 91. There's a big difference there. And so, to me, it's kind of a wake-up call to those of us in the South. You know, maybe we'll never be able to overcome that, but it looks to me like there's some potential there. And something needs to change so we can improve on that and increase the profitability of these commercial cow-calf operations. Okay, so, you know, if that is a good indication, and again, I welcome your arguments. If you think it's not, this slide represents 100 years of cattle breeding. And so I'm going to ask you as we go through this, are we improving the ability of cows relative to forage resources to survive and thrive on those resources, or are we changing other things that may be impacting that? That's a result of 100 years of breeding. All right, so let's talk about milk first. And I think this one really is the most simple one to address. It's really quite straightforward if you sort through all the scientific literature on this. And I'm going to share just a little bit with you. Dr. Stein, would you give me a hello or something, or wave at me or spit on me or something when I've got about 15 minutes left? I'd like to wrap it up so there's plenty of time for questions. Thank you. Okay, so this is a genetic trend for milk. This is a crossbreed adjusted according to the Meat Animal Research Center group's most recent adjustments there. And what you see is, and we've only got Simmental representing the continental breeds that came into the beef industry with relatively high milk production. But there are probably three of those breeds in the country, maybe four, that came into our industry with relatively high level of milk production. And basically over time, they're static to slightly declining in milk yield. For the most part, everybody else you could put in the classification of gradually increasing or aggressively selecting for milk. Okay? So, and then the Hereford breed started out with lower milk yield, and I'm going to say it right now before I forget that once we get to the end of this section, you're going to understand where I'm coming from, and most of you probably already do. But folks, this is an advantage for the Hereford breed. Okay, now, they appear to be in a hurry to screw it up. But this is an advantage to the Hereford breed. And I'm gonna show you, or try, do my best to show you why I say that. And if I were the Hereford breed, I would try to turn that trend around just about as quick as I possibly could. Okay, and if I were some of the other breeds, I would try to slow down. Slow that genetic trend down. Okay, so one concept that kind of gets overlooked, and we need to understand that, that's more milk equals higher year-long maintenance requirements. Okay, it's very clear in the literature, and I just listed two there. I could have listed maybe eight scientific studies that suggest that is true. In 1996, the National Research Council, for the first time, gave adjustment factors for breeds for maintenance energy requirement. Angus was the base at 1.0. Holsteins were 1.2, so they're suggesting Holstein cows have higher maintenance requirements of about 20%. The dairy group agrees with that. Their literature says, yep, that's right on target. So about 20%. And some of the breeds that are aggressively selecting for milk are pushing towards that maintenance requirements in Holstein. Okay, you need to understand that. And a maintenance requirement is something that's with the cow 365 days a year. It's the overhead to run the factory. It's the overhead to turn the lights on, basically. Okay, and so you need to realize that. The Hereford breed had an adjustment factor in 1996 of 0.9. So what they're doing now is pushing towards increased milk production and which will effectively increase that adjustment factor or push it closer to maintenance. Okay, so that's my little spiel on the maintenance requirements. You need to understand that. Now let's talk about the efficiency of more milk. Okay, and that's a separate issue. So here, I've got a slide from a publication of Lewis in 1990. It's a little bit cockeyed. You may have to turn your head sideways. I'm going to blame that on my graduate student, Dylan. He's the one that illegally copied it from the book. So what you see is, in a group of cows in this experiment, they had a group of cows that were bred to produce relatively low level of milk. The conversion in that first line there, that's pretty steep, was about 12 pounds of milk per pound of additional calf weight gain. Okay? Simple conversion factor, 12 to 1. The next group of cows were bred to yield moderate levels of milk over an entire lactation. Conversion is about 15 to 1. Okay, the higher yielding cows, conversion was 52 to 1. Additional milk to per unit of calf weight gain. Okay, so conversion efficiency of additional milk yield declines, according to this data set, as increase is with more milk production. Okay? Now, is that repeatable in the literature? Yes, it is. This is data that Dylan dug up on that same topic, and what he's done here is just summarized three different experiments where you could classify a high milk group and a low milk group, and you look at the conversion efficiency of additional milk to additional calf weight gain, and in each case, the ratio of total milk yield to weaning weight is substantially higher in the higher milk production group of cows. Okay, so let's just make it clear that what you're doing when you produce more and more milk is you are swapping milk, or you're swapping forage for milk, right? The calves that are consuming a lot of milk are eating less grass when as they get old enough to consume forage, and from that point forward. Okay, that's really what's going on. Now, will they grow faster? Yes. Will they have higher lean weights? Yes, they will. But it is not free, and it is actually rather inefficiency once you get to some threshold of milk production to raise a thrifty, growthy calf, healthy. Okay? So this is what I tell our producers, and our extension educators tell our producers, that when we're talking about the concept of matching cows to forage resources relative to milk production. So we need to be thinking about this question. And is there a limit of milk production that your forage and your operation can support? Is there a limit? Well, according to some of those genetic trends, most people think that if there is, they haven't found it yet, right? But if there is a limit, you would think that increased milk production would not result in increased calf growth once you go beyond that limit. Does that make sense to everybody? Because at that point, what becomes limiting? The environment. Their nutritional resources. Okay, so the other thing I tell producers when I'm talking about this is I say, just imagine, and they really seem to get it, just imagine bringing the top DHIA cow from Michigan, producing, I don't know, 120, 140 pounds of milk a day, bring her to central Oklahoma, kick her out on native pasture, maybe late summer, early fall, and give her a pound or two of cake a day. What happens to her milk production? What happens? Is it going to go down just a little bit? No, it's going to crash, right? She may go from 140 pounds to 50 or 60 pounds. I don't know. I don't know what the number would be, but it will decline drastically. Has her genetic potential changed? Well, of course not. There's a limit to milk production that her forage, that forage system can support, particularly that time of year. And obviously that's the reason why a lot of people like to have in the spring.